Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. My name is Attorney Ann Sultan. My Colorado bar number is 023464. In Jensen versus Redevelopment Agency of Sandy City, 998 F. 2nd, 1550, 10th Circuit, 1993. The court said that when a person's good name, reputation, honor, or integrity is at stake because of what the government is doing to him, a protectable liberty interest may be implicated that requires procedural due process in the form of a hearing to clear his name. In this case, A to Z Radon is a small business that provides radon mitigation services to residential customers. And the state of Colorado has developed a procedure, although radon industries are not regulated in the state, has developed a procedure to include and to exclude the names of radon mitigation companies doing business in the state. And what the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment did was to remove A to Z Radon's name from the list of companies that are providing radon mitigation services. And when a member of the general public calls to inquire about A to Z as a company in particular, or about any company, then the Colorado Department of Public Health, Christine Kelly, who is their radon manager in particular, tells that member of the general public that A to Z is a terrible company, don't use them. We have received complaints about them and we have removed them from our list. A to Z claims that these statements impugn its reputation, has resulted in it losing current and prospective customers, places it at a tremendous competitive disadvantage with hundreds of other radon mitigation companies doing business in the state, and that it is entitled to some kind of notice and hearing of complaints so that it can clear its good name. Christine Kelly, who is the manager of the radon program, has testified during the deposition that she developed a program to include and exclude, and that when she receives three customer complaints about a radon mitigation company, she removes them from the list that the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment publishes. And she uses essentially a four-step process. She gets the complaint from a member of the public. She will contact the radon mitigation company via telephone. She will talk with them on the phone about the customer's complaint. And if the customer responds back that they're satisfied with the company's response to their complaint, then that particular customer complaint is not recorded as a strike against the radon mitigation company. However, if there are three unresolved customer complaints, then Christine Kelly, in her official capacity as the state's radon manager, will then remove the company and tell members of the general public that the company was removed because the state received complaints about it that are unresolved. And she knows, given her deposition testimony, that when she so does, she places that company a competitive disadvantage.
Ms. Sultan, just so I'm clear, looking at Ms. Kelly's actions as opposed to Ms. Barkish's actions, was there evidence that Ms. Kelly had said that A to Z was a terrible company, or were her comments limited to just reporting that the name had been removed from the list because they had received consumer complaints?
The information that we received during discovery indicates that it was Ms. Kelly, Christine Kelly, who was making these statements to members of the general public. We did not have what I would call good information as we went through discovery to also allege that Ms. Bartish, too, was making those statements. But during Ms. Kelly's deposition, she did acknowledge that she had made not statements that they were a terrible company, but that the company had been removed because the state received consumer complaints about that company.
Well, that's objective, that things have been removed because they had received consumer complaints, but wasn't that process approved basically by the EPA?
No, it was not. The EPA, unfortunately, has not exercised enough oversight of this program. What the EPA essentially says in its guide that comes along with the grant money is that there are two private sector companies that are certifying Rayon mitigation contractors. One is located in North Carolina, I think the other may now be based in or around New York. And so the EPA's guide, its written directive says, anybody on the list of either the NRSB or the NRB should be included on the list that the state who receives the grant money publishes. Now, Colorado is different from several other states like Nebraska that has an actual certification program run by the state. So when Colorado receives its money from the EPA, then it's supposed to publish the entire list of those who are listed. And what Ms. Kelly testified during her deposition that she was doing was when she received the list periodically, she would then periodically remove names from the list, including the name of A to Z, because she had received in previous years these complaints. A to Z is saying, well, if you receive the complaints, why don't you give me notice? Since you've developed this process, why don't you give me notice? Why don't you give me a call so that I could respond to these consumer complaints, as I did when I received consumer complaints through the Better Business Bureau in Denver. We received 3 complaints through them. We addressed them all. And the Better Business Bureau of Denver continues to rate them A, as they maintain their A business rating, because when they were informed of complaints, they did respond to those complaints. So it's concerned with how Christine Kelly and the Colorado Department of Public Health is handling the matter, is that it's not being given notice of the complaint so that it can respond thereto, and then the state is using that as a basis to say, well, they're not on our list because we've received customer complaints, which we believe impugns the company's good name and places it at an incredible disadvantage as it's trying to keep its current customers and attract new customers. So in our the view, we believe that because Ms. Kelly has developed this process over an unregulated business, that A to Z was at least entitled to this due process. We also believe that Christine Kelly is not entitled to qualified immunity because she knew or should have known that if she was going to develop a procedure by which some companies would be placed at a competitive disadvantage, that she should have accorded that same process to all of the companies that are providing services. As the court is familiar with the standard articulated in Carlo about qualified immunity, we look at whether or not there's a constitutional violation, and then we ask the second question of whether or not it was established at the time of the actions. And we believe that the dictates of the due process clause have long been in place, and that Ms. Kelly knew or should have known about them. I would like to, if I may, reserve the rest of my time for reply.
You may, though I'll have a question. You can stop the clock for my question. Ms. Sultan, the due process argument relates to the delisting. Are you simply saying that before you can delist, you're entitled to due process or more than that?
Well, no, it's not so much the delisting that drives this case. What is driving this case is that if you call the Colorado Department of Public Health today and you say, I want some information on rayon today, about a rayon company because I bought a new house, and
yep, gonna, sure,
then if you do that today, then Ms. Kelly will say, if you ask about A to Z, she will say, we received customer complaints about that and we took them off our list.
So
we want that to stop. And if you're going to say that, then at least give the company an opportunity to clear its name, to address those complaints you say you have on file.
So the due process would be a process by which Ms. Kelly would make a determination about the merits of the complaints, and then if there was a due process in which she concluded the complaints were correct, she could say this?
Well, we don't believe that she has the authority,
okay,
to develop a quasi-judicial punitive scheme. We don't believe she has that authority, so that certainly is one of the questions that we're raising. But we're saying that if we assume that you do have the authority, then at least treat us fairly, because by not treating us fairly, not giving us an opportunity to respond to whatever complaints you have, you're hurting our business, and you're doing that today, and you know, we could be making a lot of money this summer that we're not making.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I need to follow on this one. So a couple of things. First, you say this case is about the fact that when somebody calls and asks about A to Z specifically, they will be told that there were customer complaints and that it has been removed from the list.
Yes.
Now, both of those statements are true. It is a fact that there were customer complaints. It is a fact they have been removed from the list. And yet you allege that this is defamatory. Well, truth is an absolute defense to defamation. Those statements are factually true.
Well, those statements, if you break them apart, they are factually true. If you put them together, they still impugn the good name and reputation of the company. The result is the same. The member of the general public is not going to use that company. And the fact that A to Z was not given an opportunity to address the complaints.
But I guess I don't understand. I'm not aware of any law that says that if you lose business because of something that's true, it's defamatory. I'm confused.
I think that if a state government official is going to create out of whole cloth a quasi-judicial punitive process where that person serves as the investigator, the judge, the jury, and the punisher, and they say that they've developed this system because they need to protect the consumers, and if they get three customer complaints, they're going to remove the person, and they're going to let the public know they've been removed from the list because of customer complaints, then I think the company is entitled under due process to at least get the benefit of having an opportunity to be notified of those complaints and an opportunity to respond there too.
Okay.
And if you don't do that, then you've irreparably harmed the company's reputation.
So the case really is about removal from the list, or the process for removal from the list.
It is that too, yes. It is that too. We are concerned about the delisting, but we're also seeking prospective injunctive relief to prevent the state from today saying what they've been saying for years that's been hurting this company's reputation and impairing its ability to earn income.
Well, how long has HZ known about the either the delisting or the failure to list? And I'm looking at the record, and I would say at the latest 2005.
It's been aware of it for years, and it has tried for many years on its own to try to get the state to reverse its position. And so it's only been in the relative recent past that it retained counsel to try to move this agenda through the courts and see if we could try to get the state to respond. But the statements are made today. They're currently being made, and so the harm continues, even though HZ was aware that these statements were being made as far back as perhaps 2005 and even before then.
Thank you.
Thank you, Aaron.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. My name is Slippery Steer, registration number 32061, appearing on behalf of CDPHE and Christine Kelly. Before I begin, I'd like to provide the court with three exhibits, and these are the documents that the trial court relied on in reaching its decision. Two of them are emails from 2009 from Sean Stenson, who is the CEO of AFA2Z, to Linda Bartish, an employee of CDPHE. The third exhibit is a list of telephone conversations between CDPHE and Sean Stenson that Mr. Stenson prepared and signed between April of 2004 and October of 2006.
These are in the record that is before us.
The emails can be found on record page numbers 465 through 471, and the notes can be found on record page numbers 921 through 926.
And Ms. Sultan, have you shown those copies to Ms. Sultan?
I have. Yes, and I have no objection.
Thank you. All right.
What is the? I have copies of those. What are the significance though of those documents?
No. They go directly to the process that was provided to A2Z, along with when A2Z first learned of its claim. So it goes to both statute of limitations as well as the procedural due process component of this lawsuit.
On the statute of limitations question, as Ms. Sultan says, if somebody calls up today, they're going to get a response along the lines of there have been complaints about A2Z, and they have been taken off our approved list. So why doesn't the claim survive, at least as to anything that's occurred in that regard, 2 years prior to the time the complaint was filed?
All of the claims asserted in this lawsuit are brought pursuant to 42 U.S.C. section 1983. It's a federal statute, and the federal accrual period applies. The accrual period begins from the moment a plaintiff first learns of their injury, and the continuing violations doctrine cannot apply to constitutional claims in 1983.
But here we have arguably a new act. Each time somebody calls and is given this information, we have a new act of defamation, whatever you want to characterize it as, but a new injury then each time, because that particular customer is dissuaded from using A2Z. It's not really a continuing violation. It sounds like a new violation.
But under 1983, the claim accrues from the moment you first learn that your constitutional rights are impacted. So that would be from the first time you learn that you're beginning to lose customers. Actually, it would be from the first time you actually lose a customer, because the loss of potential customers doesn't suffice for a 1983 claim. So because they first learned in 1999 that they were losing customers, that's when their claim accrued. And then 2 years to file their action. They didn't file it until March 2011. So under that basis, that the statute of limitations would apply to bar the claims.
So I guess I don't understand if there's a new act that occurred after the 2 years runs from when they first learned. How is that connected to the first act, if it is a new act?
Because it's actually the same statements. As you go through those emails and his list of the telephone conversations, notes of those, they all have the same component. That is, someone from CDPHE is telling a consumer that HEC is a terrible company, don't use them, we have complaints on file against them, and they have been removed from our list.
If I understand the answer brief correctly, you argued on page 11 that the A2Z did not present the period of limitations running from a new act argument to the trial court, yet you said on page 12 that the trial court recognized that the continuing violations aren't the basis for extending the statute of limitations. Could you explain the difference between those two and or how they're interrelated?
Certainly. The argument presented to the trial court was that because it was an ongoing statement over all these years, that the statute of limitations effectively told and continued. The argument that was presented to this court and was not presented to the trial court until ATZ responded to the motion for attorney's fees is that each new act of defamation restarts the statute of limitations claim. And that argument is based on the common law defamation, which was asserted in this lawsuit. This lawsuit concerned a 1983 constitutional violation. However, even if the claims weren't barred, there's still a rather large procedural hurdle that ATZ has to overcome before you need to consider the constitutional claims here. And that is their request for money damages. And ATZ, in their notice of claim to the Attorney General's office, asserted a claim for over $500,000 in damages. The claims are asserted pursuant to Section 1983, which applies to persons. The United States Supreme Court has ruled time and again that neither the state, its agencies, nor its employees in their official capacities are persons for money damage purposes. Now that leaves Christine Kelly in her personal capacity. And a state employee suing their personal capacity is entitled to qualified immunity in all but exceptional cases. And the burden to overcome qualified immunity is on the plaintiff. To do so, they have to show a clearly established constitutional right, not just an established constitutional right. For it to be clearly established, there has to be a Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals case or a United States Supreme Court case that's on point. And that has never been presented in this case. In fact, in the reply brief on page 10, A2Z states, I'll quote, there is no case law directly on point that addresses these issues, particularly as they arise from the facts and circumstances of a case involving an unregulated business enterprise. That's basically an admission that qualified immunity has to apply in this case. So, irrespective of the statute of limitations, no damages claim can go forward here.
What about the injunctive claim?
The injunctive claim could still go forward if the limitations period didn't apply. And that'll lead me into their substantive claims. And I can discuss a little bit about their procedural due process, substantive due process, and equal protection claims. Procedural due process, as you're aware, prohibits the state from depriving an entity of their property or liberty interests without notice and an opportunity to be heard. And it is an opportunity to be heard, not necessarily a hearing, depending on the deprivation that's involved. Here, AGZ has asserted that they have some sort of interest in their reputation. However, in 1976, the United States Supreme Court in Paul v. Davis said, and I'll quote, interest in reputation is neither liberty nor property guaranteed against state deprivation without due process of law. And that's 424 U.S. 693, page 712. Reputation can be the basis of a liberty interest claim based on stigma plus test. And stigma plus must basically be defamation, in this case, the loss of a current ongoing business relationship. Here, there's been no allegation of a false statement. It's true that CDPHE has complaints on file against A2Z. And in fact, in those emails that I referenced previously, Mr. Stenson, and this is an important point, admits that he picked up those complaints directly from Linda Bartish at CDPHE on February 11th, 2009. And I understand that he's alleged now that he's never had notice of these complaints, but contemporaneously with the fact he actually admits that he picked them up. Also, opinions can't be the basis of a defamation claim or stigma plus test. So any allegations to the worth of AGZ services can't be the basis for the claim.
Well, an opinion can't be the basis if it's a pure opinion, but an opinion that implies that it's based upon factual information can be the basis of a defamation or Section 1983 claim, isn't that right?
That's correct, yes.
And here, the context is, we've received complaints, they're a terrible company. So there's an implied factual basis, isn't there?
That they have complaints.
That they're a terrible company. I mean, there's an implied factual basis for the opinion that they're a terrible company.
Well, still, as to the value of services, that's what I believe is referred to as pure opinion. And that is discussed in the case of NBC subsidiary KNCTV Inc. versus Lydia Wilson in the Colorado Supreme Court in 1994, which is in the briefs. However, even if they adequately alleged the false statement, they never presented any evidence of publication to a third entity or a third party. The last evidence is of 2006 in Mr. Stenson's affidavit of his conversations with Ms. Kelly, and those conversations were between him and his employees and Ms. Kelly, not of a public party. And they never alleged that a present, or they never specifically identified a ongoing business relationship that was terminated because of the statements. Now, they do argue that they have a property interest in being listed, being placed on the CDPHE list in their briefs. The CDPHE list is mandated by the EPA. Property interest for due process can only be created by state law, and the EPA is a federal actor. And in any event, the EPA requires CDPHE to list certified radon mitigation providers. The only evidence in the record is that A2Z was never certified to provide radon mitigation services. Certifications are only given to individuals, which would be Sean Stenson in this matter. He was certified for a while, but A2Z never was. And as a result, the trial court found that A2Z had no interest to proceed with their claims.
So are you saying that this list that is maintained by the department is solely a list of individuals?
It does have the individual listed and the company they're affiliated with. However, if Mr. Stenson, A2Z, was not certified and Mr. Stenson was also not certified at a certain point, then neither had any basis being on the list.
But if Mr. Stenson was certified, then they both would have been on the list.
They both would have been on the list unless they were removed.
Okay.
Mr. Stenson was decertified.
For a one-year period, as I understand it?
No, he was subsequently decertified by the National Environmental Health Association, NEHA.
So that's his current status?
His current status is he's not certified. He complained about this to CDPHE about not being or being removed once he was decertified. That's in those emails. He states that he spent 8 months speaking with a Steve at CDPHE, that's Steve Tarleton, one of the witnesses in the case. And he also states that Mr. Tarleton agreed that once he was certified, recertified by NEHA, he would be placed on the list. To date, that hasn't happened. And one other point, because there was a statement, I believe, and it's also in the briefs, that CDPHE has no authority whatsoever to regulate these lists. Ms. Kelly actually testified that, and this all just quotes from the record, page 1245, I was given permission from the EPA to regulate the list or produce the list as we saw fit. So there have been two companies removed from the list. One is A2Z, and I don't know the name of the other company today. A2Z has also asserted claims for substantive due process and equal protection. Substantive due process and equal protection generally govern fundamental rights. Fundamental rights include the right to marry, the right to raise your children, and bodily integrity. The case law is clear that fundamental rights do not include reputation, economic well-being, or the right to practice a chosen profession. The trial court found that there's no fundamental right involved here. A2Z has also alleged violation of equal protection based on the fact that, based on the allegation that CDPHE does not have a rational basis for removing it from its list. The trial court expressly found that there's a rational basis for removing companies with unresolved consumer complaints against it. That is consumer protection. And there's a presumption of a rational basis that has to be accepted and that the plaintiff has to overcome. There is the defamation claim that is still out there. It was asserted pursuant to Section 1983, federal law. There is no federal common law, so there is no defamation claim under federal law. The trial court addressed the defamation claim as a state law claim and dismissed it under the Colorado Government Immunity Act. Under the CGIA, defamation is not a waived area, so there's no jurisdiction over the claim unless an exception applies. There is no allegation, well, there was an allegation of willful and wanton conduct, but it didn't meet the pleading requirements of the CGIA, and that exact animus or ill will of Ms. Kelly was never alleged. Additionally, AGZ did not file a notice of claim until 2010. The last evidence of any statement by Ms. Kelly is in 2006. The notice of claim statute is 180 days, 6 months. So they missed that. It's a jurisdictional requirement, not subject to the doctrine of continuing violations or equitable tolling. Lastly, we come to the issue of the trial court's award of attorney's fees, which AGZ has challenged on this appeal. In the briefs to this court, the state has cited, I believe, 5 federal cases holding that the failure to meet the statute of limitations in the 1983 claim subjects the claimant to attorney's fees. Under 1983, a plaintiff automatically receives their attorney's fees when they're successful. That is to promote civil rights, to ensure that people are supported in their effort to come forward and make sure the state isn't acting inappropriately. However, that has also led to a proliferation of cases where plaintiffs are coming forward with everyday tort claims, such as for defamation, and asserting constitutional violations, which is clogging the courts. Now, under 1988, a defendant is entitled to their fees when such a claim is brought without substantial justification, irrespective of subjective intent. Now, AGZ argues that fees are not appropriate here because in their reply brief, they state, and I quote, whether or not a private company has a constitutional right to notice and an opportunity to be heard before a state government agency and or its employee impute the private company's good name and reputation is an unresolved legal issue. But it's not an unresolved legal issue. The Supreme Court and Paul B. Davis ruled on the issue 36 years ago. It's been the law of the land for that period of time, and that's one of the main reasons why the state filed its attorney's fees before the trial court, and one of the reasons the trial court awarded it. Finally, I would just point out that if you take a look at those two emails, they undercut everything that ATZ is alleging here. ATZ knew of its damages and knew of these statements back in 1999. It called them libel and slander in its emails. It said it was preparing a lawsuit. It just never brought it. It admits in those emails that it collected the complaints, that it was given those complaints by CDGHE in hard copy form. It admits that it had 8 months to discuss those complaints with CDPHE, and that CDPHE agreed to place it back on the list as soon as it was served. And thank you to the court for their time today.
Ms. Dalton?
I'd like to address just a couple of the points that the counsel raised. One is that in Walker v. Associated Press, 160 Colorado 361, 1966, the court said that each time a false and defamatory statement is made, the statute of limitations begins to run. And in a more recent case, that of Gordon v. Boyles, 99P3rd, 75, Colorado Appellate, 2004, this court again indicated that each radio broadcast is a single publication, so each time a defamatory statement is made, a new cause of action arises. Paul B. Davis talks more about the alteration of one's status when the government has made, or the government agent has made defamatory statements about a private citizen. And since it was decided, there has been a host of decisions that have been decided by the 10th Circuit and a few that have been decided at the Colorado state level relating to the procedural safeguards in place when someone's name is at issue. Among those cases is Hicks v. versus the city of Watonga, spelled W-A-T-O-N-G-A, Oklahoma, at 942 F. 2nd 737, 10th Circuit, 1991, wherein the court said due process requires that an employee whose liberty interest is threatened be afforded notice and hearing to provide the person an opportunity to clear his name. We also have the more recent decision in Darr, D-A-R-R, versus Town of Telluride, Colorado, at 495 F. 3rd 1243, 10th Circuit decision, 2007, wherein the court held a person has a liberty interest in her good name and reputation as they relate to the employment of that person. We also have a 2011 decision in Merrifield versus Board of County Commissioners, 654 F. 3rd 1073, 10th Circuit, wherein the court talks about the due process that is in place, and the inquiry contains two steps. Did the person possess a protected interest? And if so, was that person afforded an appropriate level of process? A to Z contends that it was not afforded an appropriate level of process before disparaging statements were said and are being said to members of the general public. In the record, there is evidence showing that Ms. Kelly has made these statements to third parties.
Well, what evidence is that? There is evidence that she made them to A2Z employees posing as third parties.
There may be evidence in the record that those statements also were made to one of the customers. I'm sorry, I don't recall that particular customer's name at the moment, but there was a customer who made an inquiry, and I believe that too is in the record. Also in the record is the, I think it's a 40-page document that lists the complaints against all of the companies providing radon mitigation and installation-related services. And that list is freely distributed. I believe in the record we indicate that we requested it and that information was provided us even before we became involved in this particular lawsuit. So I do believe that there is some information in there that shows that the information was communicated. Also, Ms. Kelly, in her deposition, she testified that she does tell people when they call in these things. So that is from her own words.
I'm also curious about whether either Mr. Stinson or A2Z is currently certified by either NEHA or NRSB.
To my knowledge, neither is.
Or has been since early 2009, as I gather from his affidavit.
I believe that since about March of 2009, they have not been.
So what's the basis for injunctive relief? Even under your theory, they have no right to be on the list.
Well, we still are very much concerned about the negative comments that are being made by the state agency that impugn A to Z's reputation, and it is harming its ability to secure prospective customers, as well as it's harming its ability to retain its current customers because of the statements that Ms. Kelly is making.
But even under your theory, the department could still tell customers they're not on the list. They've had complaints because they're not entitled to be on the list. They're not certified.
I think what the state could say is they're not on the list. I think they could say that. But I don't think they can say they're not on the list, we took them off because of customer complaints. Because A2Z never had notice of those complaints, never was given an opportunity to address those complaints. That's the problem. So if the state is saying, well, they're not on the list, they're currently not certified.
So your position is ultimately they have to have some kind of a hearing every time there's a complaint?
No. They have to have it. They're entitled to notice of the complaint and a hearing if the state is going to say we remove them from the list because we received customer complaints.
because it is Ms. Kelly who put into place the procedure that said, we will give you notice of these complaints and we'll give you an opportunity to respond before we remove you and let the public know that that's what we're doing.
Do I understand your argument to be that if all they did was remove them from the list, that there would be no requirement, there would be no due process requirement?
I think that that is probably correct. That if they just said, well, they're not on the list, you know, they're not certified, they're not on our list, because of the several hundred companies providing the service, we only list the 100 that are certified by these two national outfits, I think that's okay. But the way that they're doing it is harming A to Z's ability to keep current customers and to attract new business. Ms. Kelly testified during her deposition that she put into place this procedure. We believe A to Z was entitled to it. She also testified during her deposition, and this is part of the record, that she knows that when she makes these statements to the public that it harms A to Z. She knows that.
Thank you, Ms. Elton.
Thank you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, counsel. We now accept this case as submitted, and we will issue an opinion in due course.